Welcome aboard.
My name is Josh Gilliland of the Legal Geeks. Thank you all for joining us on a Sunday morning on day three of a Comic-Con. Are you ready to talk Star Trek?
Yes.
Are you ready for lots of legal analysis?
Yes.
Then you are in the right place. Our panel today is one of the most legally sophisticated I've ever moderated. Appearing in alphabetical order, we have Bethany Bangford, who is an associate at DLA Piper, who focuses on patent litigation. Neil Carretree at Goodwin, who is one of the top IP lawyers in the country, and his claim to fame includes representing Facebook and their big case depicted in The Social Network. Mark Lemley of Stanford University, who is the director of the Stanford Program in Law, Science, and Technology. Christine Peek, Ed McManus Faulkner, civil rights lawyer and civil litigator, and Angela Story of Story and Story, who is a civil litigator. Our agenda will cover many of the constitutional and civil rights issues depicted in Star Trek. Now, Star Trek is great because of all the series, everyone has at least one trial, with Deep Space Nine having the most at 7. So all of them have touched on this, some multiple times, and we'll pick and choose some of the top issues. There's no way to cover all of them because that would be a full day seminar getting into this.
Wait, this isn't a full day seminar?
Sadly, no. We will begin with a quantum leap over to the Enterprise episode Judgment. We will talk about the right to counsel. And Christine, can you take us away?
So in our system, the counsel clause of the Sixth Amendment is what guarantees criminal defendants the right to have an attorney represent them in any case that could result in a sentence of actual imprisonment. The Klingon system appears to have a similar guarantee because Archer is assigned Kolos as his advocate in this episode. The Sixth Amendment right in our system has also been interpreted to include the right to reasonably effective assistance of counsel, but it's very difficult to establish a violation of that right. So the defendant not only has to show that counsel made errors, but the errors were so serious that they prejudiced the defense. And a showing of prejudice usually means that absent the unprofessional errors, the result of the proceeding would have been different.
Neil, let's talk about Kolos, the defense attorney, and do you think he was effective counsel for Captain Archer?
So the answer is kind of yes and kind of no. If you watch the episode at the very beginning, they put in all of this damaging evidence against Jonathan Archer, complete mischaracterization of the facts like us litigators sometimes do. And when the defense lawyer is asked to go and put his side of the case on, he says, "I have nothing," which is not a typical defense maneuver. You try and put on your side of the case. And basically what happens is Jonathan Archer's in the holding cell, and the lawyer comes back, and this isn't the exact dialogue, and I know that being imprecise on Star Trek programs is always a tremendous mistake, but he says, "Come on, man, that's not really a defense." And he says, "You got into being a defender for a reason, and you got into being a lawyer for a reason," and gives this big inspirational speech. And then Kolos ultimately comes on, and he puts on a very, very forceful defense of Jonathan Archer, and he's still found guilty, and it is such a forceful defense, and the lawyer feels so strongly, he actually gets given the same sentence. And ends up in the same place. Now,
as a lawyer, I'm opposed to that.
I'm against that part of the outcome. I mean, sometimes you win, sometimes you lose. But you know, if I'm sentenced to the dilithium crystal mines, it's not really a good system of justice.
Well, let's talk about the trial itself. And this, we have Duras testify. And there's a lot of mischaracterizations of the facts that the former captain testifies to. And Christine, what would you do if you had been putting together the cross-examination of Duras, since Archer's defense attorney chooses not to cross him?
So I think the key to crossing Duras is to attack his credibility. He's Orak, the prosecutor's only witness, and he's a big liar. So even though Kolos may be onto something and he says, okay, this guy's not going to say anything that's going to help you, yeah, maybe not on purpose, but that doesn't mean there's no value in crossing him. And I think the key to picking him apart may actually lie in another thing that Kolos says later in that episode. He asks, what honor is there in victory over a weaker opponent? But everybody who's in the room in that trial knows that Duras actually lost to a weaker opponent. So he has motive to lie, to try to save face. So I would try and warm him up with some questions that he's probably going to say yes to that reinforce that he has the better ship, he's the better fighter. Humans are not good fighters. And then I would move on to questions that he can't really say no to because the whole reason they're there, that Archer is on trial. And that's the fact that Duras lost, despite being the better fighter with the better ship. So, and I would argue then to the judge that Duras' incompetence and the dishonor and the shame of his failure shows he really has motive to lie. So I think just going over those facts that reinforce that dishonor and making sure the judge remembers them is the key to attacking his credibility.
Which brings us to the comparison of Klingon jurisprudence and the U.S. system. And Bethany, how are the two similar and how are they different?
Well, to the question of how similar is Klingon jurisprudence to the United States, the answer is very. It's kind of the difference between Klingon law and Federation law is very similar to the difference between the adversarial and inquisitorial systems of law. The U.S., we use an adversarial system, which basically means that you have two different parties, they are fighting each other, while the judge is supposed to be a neutral arbiter and kind of determine the truth based on neutral objective standards while watching these two parties. The inquisitorial system, which is in civil law countries like France and Italy, the judge is much more active in gathering evidence, in, you know, asking for witnesses and all of that, and it's supposed to be a search for the truth, and the judge's job is to find the truth versus be a neutral arbiter. Now, the Klingons, they say, the truth must be won. I'll see you on the battlefield. So it's a very, it's adversarial, it's combative, it's the way things are in the U.S., where, you know, we fight with opposing counsel, and we have all of that, and so it's very similar in that way. Whereas, you know, the Federation comes back and says, this is not a fight, it is a search for the truth, and that is very inquisitorial. Now, some of the ways that the U.S. system has been criticized is by the principle of equality of arms. When you're in combat, it means that the side that has better resources, is better equipped, has better lawyers, will often win, and that's a criticism, and it's the same with Klingon law. You know, one major difference is that Klingon law tends to be a bit more combative, taking a bit more literally. It's a little rougher, but it's definitely a system that we recognize here.
Some patent litigation, I think, is probably approaches Klingon in terms of level of actual physical combat.
let me just add one thing, is that at the very beginning of the episode, Jonathan Archer's asked to give a plea, which is a very common thing in a criminal procedure. And he says, I'm not guilty. And what the judge says is we'll reconvene for you to prove your innocence. And as you might know, in the United States, you're innocent until proven guilty. But clearly in the Klingon system, it's the opposite. You have to prove your innocence.
Well, it would be unfair to put an innocent person on trial, so.
Oh, the police state. For our guests who just joined us, there's a bench on the side and there are other chairs up in the front if you'd like to sit. Which brings us to our next issue, assumption of risk and wearing a red shirt. Because when you think back to the original series of the 59 deaths that we saw over the first three seasons, a total of 43 red shirts died on away missions. That's a 70% fatality rate. The only thing higher would be being the commanding officer of the Battlestar Pegasus and Battlestar Galactica, where they lost 3 out of 4 commanders, and that's really high at 75%. And, of course, being a mom in a Disney movie. Especially a mom in a red shirt in a Disney movie.
Dressed as a deer.
Yeah, she's a deer. Say goodbye. We'll take questions at the end, but yes, we do want questions, so stay tuned. So with that, let's talk about you joined Starfleet at the time of Kirk and Spock, and you're in engineering or security. Let's talk about being a red shirt.
not a good place to be. You could be turned into a mineral cube and stepped on. You can be vaporized, step on an exploding rock. It's a highly dangerous job. In the law, we have something that's called assumption of the risk, where the courts have determined that there are certain activities that are just inherently dangerous. And you know that there is a risk of being injured. It's an obvious risk. So, for instance, if you go skiing and somebody kind of cuts you off and you break your leg, you can't sue them because it's an assumption of the risk. Skiing is inherently dangerous. So is being a red shirt. With that kind of death rate, it's clear that if you put on a red shirt in the original way mission and you go down, you have assumed the risk that you are going to die. You don't get to turn around and sue Kirk for that. Other places that this happens, there's falling into a fire at Burning Man, for instance, is an assumption of the risk because approaching a fire, you know it's dangerous, you know there's a risk of falling in.
Being a fireman, being a paramedic, lots of careers that are inherently dangerous.
As the guy wearing a red shirt on the panel, I just want to make clear that I believe there is an exception if your name was in the credits. Then I think you're safe. We'll see.
The Scotty Clause. Which brings us to the wonderful world of patent litigation that we saw in iMUD. And Mark, can you help us understand what we learned about patent litigation in the 23rd century?
Well, so the Star Trek universe is, I think, in general, a very optimistic, rational vision of the future, right? If you compare it to even to Star Wars or certainly to kind of most of the modern science fiction, which is very dystopian, right? The idea is kind of we've figured out most of the system of justice. We've figured out most of the way societies can integrate. It's not, however, a perfect system. There is still patent law and patent infringement. And in one particular episode, iMUD, this is not a Starfleet rule, but a local planetary rule. It turns out that iMUD, who probably deserves the death penalty for various offenses, is actually faced with the death penalty for patent infringement. And he observes that in his planet, the death penalty applies if you engage in patent infringement. There are a wide variety of choices of ways to die, but that can be patent infringement. As a member of this panel and someone who participated in putting together all of these slides and images, I am hopeful that the same is not true of copyright infringement, because if so, we are in trouble.
Fair use. Fair use shields. Which brings us to The Doctor and His Aspiring Hollow Novels in Voyager. And Neil, can you talk us through author?
So this is one of my favorite, but not my favorite, of the various Star Trek episodes. This is an episode called Author. And, you know, one of the best things about Star Trek, there are two things that I love about it. One is its view of diversity in the future and the representation of multiple different even species. And the second is the study of humanity. And what is humanity? And how do you determine if someone has enough cognitive abilities to be entitled to various kinds of protections. In Author, what happens is the Doctor, who's a hologram, creates a work of fiction for the holodeck. He actually kind of displays a lot of the people that are on the Voyager team in somewhat of a negative light and has this kind of, it's kind of a sort of a play of sorts on the holodeck. And he decides he wants to try and publish it for other people to experience. And what happens is the publisher, a lot of the crew members get really irritated about this because they said, you're making us look bad. And he decides he doesn't want to publish it. And the publisher says, too bad, so sad, you're not a human, you can't do anything, you have no rights to any intellectual creation you created. And there's actually a legal proceeding about him asserting his rights. And when I rewatched this, I thought it was great. It reminded me of that monkey selfie case. You see that monkey, this monkey selfie. There was actually a lawsuit where our friend here actually filed a lawsuit to try and get copyright protection for the monkey who took all these cool pictures. And what I included up here is a quote from it's not on there, I don't think. Maybe it is. But the judge in the court ultimately said that only humans get copyright protection. Now, hopefully, in the world that we envision in Star Trek in the 23rd century, you know, we've kind of evolved. Because could you imagine what that would be if all sorts of sentient beings couldn't protect their rights? You know, things like Klingon opera or things like that would be fundamentally unprotectable, and then it would be copyright infringement results in death. And ultimately they give the Doctor his rights. There are a lot of other legal arguments one could raise about things that he did, but very interesting case about the legal protection of a hologram doing inventive works. I think that leads us to the next topic, actually.
It does.
Yes, Ode to Spock. So let's talk about Commander Data.
Right. Yeah, so this is, of course, one of the sort of fundamental legal disputes in Star Trek, and we're going to talk about various aspects of it, right? The question of whether Data is a human or a human equivalent, I guess, would be the relevant term. But it comes, I think, in an interesting way. It starts with the episode that from Voyager that Neil just mentioned, because there is a kind of fundamental sense in which we think that one of the attributes that makes us human, that distinguishes us from every other animal, is our creativity. It's our ability to create things, to invent things, right? And so one of the characteristics of the Doctor in the Voyager episode, but also obviously one of the characteristics of Data throughout the entirety of Next Generation, is his creativity, his desire to understand music, his desire to generate music, to generate art. And that's something that I think has some fundamental resonance in law and U.S. history. There is a rather remarkable case from the 1840s in which a slave invented something and wanted to apply for a patent. And the court said, nobody can have a patent on this because the slave can't be an inventor, because the slave's not actually a person. The slave is property. And the owner of the slave can't be an inventor because they didn't actually make the thing. Right? So the court is, in a really sort of jarring and shocking way, I think, equating what it is to be fully human with the ability to actually create. And so I think one of the things that doesn't finally resolve the trial and measure of a man, but really is a kind of important subtext here, is if we think that this is in fact somebody who's creating, who's making something new, then really they are, if not human, at least somebody we ought to be contemplating giving rights to. And that's going to be relevant, I think, well before the 23rd century, as we have artificial intelligence and other issues. All right, Bethany's going to talk about, I think, some of the trial issues.
Right, so one of the more overt messages in this episode, Measure of a Man, is the human history of slavery and how we have justified slavery in the past by saying, oh, these other races are subhuman, they aren't as intelligent, they aren't as developed as we are, and therefore, like, slavery is okay. And so one of the main themes here is that who are we to define who is and who is not sentient, who is and who is not human? And, you know, it really speaks of U.S. history. There was a famous case, Johnson versus Mintosh, where they're going in and they're trying to justify taking away land from the Native Americans. And so they go through this case and they talk about, you know, the rights of the conquered, how they've been conquered, and the divine Christian mandate. And they say, but they do say at the end of the case, but they do have some rights because they are human, unlike the Chinese. And so it's kind of this issue here that they're addressing in Star Trek, is like, when we try to make those choices, those decisions ourselves, we always get it wrong, so we shouldn't. And also that, like, there's kind of like the artificial intelligence angle too, which is like, yeah, Data is created, and we can certainly program things to not have choices. Like, I would be really angry if my coffee maker just decided one morning it didn't want to make me coffee.
A lot of people would be really angry.
Yeah, that's true. I am a coffee addict, so everything would go wrong for everyone that day. But when you program something to have choices and to be able to articulate those choices, is it then right to try to take those away? And I think that's an important question.
Which brings us to one of the other complicated trial issues that was depicted in Measure of a Man, in which Riker is compelled to play prosecutor. And he doesn't like that because Data is his friend. And it raises an interesting issue called the duty of loyalty. And Neil, can you walk us through what those issues were with Commander Riker and whether or not he met his duty?
Sure. So in the backdrop of this case, what happens is they have to have this legal proceeding about, you know, whether Data is property or not, like Mark talked about. And they need someone to prosecute that, but because they're in another region where there aren't really prosecutors, there's a Federation policy and set of regulations where basically the judge appoints someone to be the prosecutor. So the judge here appoints Commander Riker, and his response is kind of like this. And he actually says, I can't do this job because I disagree with the position. Now, as lawyers, lawyers are often faced with this question of, you may have a sound and credible argument, legal or factually, where you can set forth the theory, even if it may not be consistent with your own personal point of view. And that's an issue that lawyers are confronted with all the time, advocating for your clients. If you think about a public defender, some questions people say is, how can you represent guilty people? And, you know, the way that it makes sense is that people who are accused of crimes are entitled to a lawyer to defend them for whatever the issues may be. And the question is, can the prosecutor meet their burden of proof, not whether the person did it or not? And so Commander Riker works forcefully, really, to prosecute this question of the fact that Data's property. He takes off Data's arm in the middle of the proceeding to say, you know, could a sentient life form have this happen? He turns Data off by just touching his neck during the proceeding, and Data turns off. And it's this very dramatic, kind of forceful advocacy. And because his duty of loyalty was to the Federation as the, in essence, lawyer, you know, he pursued the case vigorously, even when he had a position that he didn't agree with. And before you get, you know, to Captain Picard's response, it was a fairly compelling presentation.
Which brings us to the next issue, and Angela, help us out here. Let's say your chief engineer is possessed by Jack the Ripper and kills three women in under 20 minutes, that the first officer on a ship has a City Alpha 5 eel wrapped around his cerebral cortex and he's making bad life choices, or if someone's been assimilated by the Borg and kills over 11 million Federation citizens. What do we got here?
Well, potentially, if you commit a criminal act while under the influence of a hostile alien, you potentially could have an insanity defense, depending on, however, whether we're talking about the original series, Next Generation, or the movies, that can change. So when the original series aired, the insanity defense in the U.S. federally was the irresistible impulse test, meaning that because of some sort of mental disease, or in this case, being taken over by an alien, you were unable to control your impulses or to control your urges to commit that crime. So, for instance, Wolf in the Fold, Scotty's taken over by Jack the Ripper, clearly can't control his own impulses, kills these women. He probably is very likely going to get off not guilty by reason of insanity.
Well, Dr. McCoy is a horrible psychologist.
Chekhov, let's go hypothetically, had he actually shot Kirk? Well, interestingly enough, when Wrath of Khan came out, federal law was still using the irresistible impulse test. Shortly after the Wrath of Khan, and because of the Reagan attempted assassination, the federal law changed. So it's no longer could you not control your impulses, it's were you unable to appreciate the wrongfulness of your action? So had that been the law at the time of Wrath of Khan, clearly had Chekhov shot Kirk, he would not be able to use the insanity defense because he understood and appreciated the wrongfulness of his actions. Bethany, did you want to talk about Picard?
Yeah, sure. So kind of along those lines, when Captain Picard was assimilated by the Borg and, you know, he is doing and providing information that is, you know, kills thousands of people, and he too probably would have won under the irresistible impulse standard because he really didn't really very much have control of those actions. He couldn't really stop that. But the new standard, whether he understands and appreciates the wrongfulness of his acts, I mean, that episode Home kind of drove home that he knew what was happening when he was doing it. He understood that it was wrong, that he was still mentally present, and it tortures him. And he has a really hard time with it, and so it's possible that he could have lost under that defense. However, all the insanity itself, defense itself, really goes to the mental state of the person, and that is the mens rea, a legal term. But there's also something called the actus reus, which is whether or not there's been a criminal act. And so what Captain Picard could probably use is a legal principle called automatism, which is very rarely used in legal jurisprudence. But essentially it's saying there was no criminal act because there was no voluntariness in the action at all. So like people who are sleepwalking sometimes use this defense, or people who are, you know, otherwise unconscious. And so he would say, I had no voluntariness in my actions. The thing here is it has to be a total loss of control, though, so he would have to argue that despite the fact he was able to communicate eventually, that he had no control at all. And then there are also, in certain other cases, like the episode where there is, some holes in space so that people start getting enraged, there's what we call the heat of passion defense, also known as the cheating wife defense. Essentially, it says that if you are justifiably enraged in a way that other people would understand, so if you walked in on your wife cheating with some other man and got so angry, then it reduces a murder charge to manslaughter, essentially, that you were in the heat of passion. And that doesn't really apply to Picard here, but is also an alternative to the insanity defense.
One thing I'll just note about both of those, right? Heat of passion doesn't say you get off, right? It says you get your punishment is less severe, right? We punish you for a smaller legal offense. And even the insanity defense, while it nominally results in an acquittal or really ends up incarcerating the person effectively, sometimes for longer than they would have been criminally sentenced, because we end up almost always institutionalizing people mentally. So I don't think it's looking pretty bleak for much of the officer corps under either of the insanity defense tests, because they're still going into psychiatric facilities.
And in most of the Klingon system of justice, your intentions don't matter. So whether you're insane or not doesn't matter.
Right.
So if I had said in law school, oh, I was assimilated by the Borg, would that have worked?
I thought that's what law school was.
Which brings us to the next issue of Drumhead, which has some great constitutional lessons, and Angie and Mark, can you walk us through them?
Right, so this is one of my favorite episodes, and I think it's relevant at the time that it aired, it's relevant today. This is one where it starts off, an investigation starts off about sabotage and quickly escalates into a full-blown McCarthyism. Just everybody is guilty of something. We may not know what it is, but you're guilty of something. Tarsis, who was initially questioned about the sabotage, the Betazoid could tell he's lying about something. Can't really say what exactly he's lying about, but he says he's lying. And as a result, the Admiral asks him to be confined to quarters. And Picard rightly says, I am not going to confine him to quarters on the basis of a Betazoid intuition. This is a lot like, for instance, a polygraph. Defendants take polygraphs all the time, but you cannot use those in court. They are not scientifically proven to be reliable enough to be used as evidence in a trial. It's very similar to a Betazoid intuition. Yes, it can be right, but it's not. In this case, it wasn't right. He was lying about his heritage, not about the sabotage, but you couldn't tell the difference. And very much like a polygraph, you can tell if somebody's lying, but you can't say exactly what it is they're lying about. This is also an episode where we hear about one of the guarantees in the Constitution of the United Federation of Planets. We know there are a number of them, but we only actually know specifically what two are?
A couple,
two,
yeah.
Or three are. In this case, the seventh guarantee is that no person shall be compelled to testify against themselves. Verbatim, essentially, for our Fifth Amendment. One of the interesting things, and Josh and I talked about this, is in Star Trek, they have these rights. Nobody ever invokes them. Like, oh no, I'm going to keep testifying. And no! Stop talking. You've got a right to a lawyer. I don't need a lawyer. You need a lawyer. I don't care how innocent you are, get a lawyer. But in Star Trek, they tend to work these things out, you know, kind of more informally. Don't do that in the U.S. Invoke your rights and ask for a lawyer.
And the other right, one of the other rights you get in the United States, and ultimately plays a role in Drumhead, is the right in criminal cases to a public trial. This is interesting because I think we think of the public trial right as a defendant protective mechanism, right? I can't be sort of locked away in a star chamber with a prosecutor and a judge and no one sees me again. That's something we view as associated with repressive regimes. The interesting thing about Drumhead is that in Tarsus's case, it seems at least at first that it's going to work in the opposite direction, right? That as this becomes a witch hunt, the public nature of the trial actually becomes the sort of thing that impels people to conclude that he's guilty. There's a very there's a problem of the sort of group rush to judgment, right? Not using legal procedure, but using kind of what we see as the likely outcome. Ultimately, the public trial is the thing that vindicates him, right? Ultimately, I think the fact that he can sort of clear his name in the public is something that might not have happened at all if the trial had been private. The other thing I think that this episode raises is the role of a criminal prosecutor and the limits on the role of a criminal prosecutor. So Neil talked earlier about the duty of loyalty and the duty to zealously represent your client, even if you don't necessarily agree with it. But that duty has limits. Even in a civil case, that duty has limits. You can't knowingly make a false statement of fact or law or fail to correct a false statement of material fact or law. That's ABA Model Rule 3.3A1. Or offer evidence that you know to be false, 3.383. We have more serious restrictions in the criminal context, though, because we hold prosecutors to a higher standard. Right? We think the power dynamic is sufficiently imbalanced if you've got the entire apparatus of the state coming against you, that we also require you as a prosecutor to refrain from prosecuting a charge that the prosecutor knows is not supported by probable cause. And as the court said in In Re Doe, when a government lawyer with enormous resources at his or her disposal abuses this power and ignores ethical standards, he or she not only undermines the public trust, but inflicts damage beyond calculation to our system of justice. This alone compels the responsible and ethical expertise of this power. Now, this is something that I think gets played a little fast and loose with in the Star Trek universe, in part because I think we are operating on Starfleet more as an inquisitorial system, more as the prosecutor is out to find the truth. But I do think sort of even in our adversarial system, but even in Star Trek, right, it's incumbent on the prosecutors of the world not just to sort of make the best argument they can make, but sometimes to decide this isn't an argument that I should be making. Defense lawyers don't have that obligation. Their goal is to do the best job for their clients, but the lawyers for the government should be held to a higher standard.
Which brings us to the villain with the best sense of dinner fashion. Let's talk about Space Seed and whether or not Kirk was right to sentence Khan and his followers to City Alpha 5.
Well, Josh, this is an incredibly complex question. And I'm not sure there's a perfect modern law analogy for everything that happens in about the last 5 minutes or so of that episode, but there's some pretty close analogies. But I think to start attacking this problem, you first have to recognize there's two classes of defendants here. There's Lieutenant MacGyver's, and then there's everybody else. There's Khan and his followers. And then as to those two classes of defendants, I think you have to try and answer two questions. So, number one, what exactly is Kirk's jurisdiction to try any of these people anyways? And number two, is the punishment itself a legal punishment? So MacGyver's is actually the easier case. She's the ship's historian who tries to help Khan take over the Enterprise. And the series references a Federation Uniform Code of Justice. So if we assume that that is roughly parallel to the Uniform Code of Military Justice in American military law, then MacGyver's, the historian, would clearly be subject to jurisdiction under it because she's a regular crew member on duty at the time. She tries to help Khan take over the Enterprise. And as to the legality of her sentence, Kirk basically gives her the choice of going with Khan and his followers or getting a court-martial, and she chooses to go with Khan and his followers. So there's some analogous authority for that in military law in the form of an administrative discharge other than honorable, or OTH. So there's an army regulation that authorizes a commander who's exercising general court-martial authority to direct a discharge under other than honorable conditions in lieu of a court-martial, and under Chapter 10 of that regulation, somebody like MacGyver's could request that. So if you're counsel for MacGyver's and you're trying to help her get the best resolution for her case, you probably would advise her to try to seek that resolution, try to get it, because her crimes are really serious. She's committed mutiny, she's committed aiding the enemy. Those crimes are, under the modern law, potentially punishable by death if she were to actually go through a court-martial. So that's probably her best option under the circumstances. As to Khan and his followers, they pose a much trickier jurisdictional problem because they're not crew members, and it's hard to fit them in under any of the other provisions of the UCMJ. One way you could try to squeeze them in is see if they can be classified as prisoners of war, because that is covered in the plain text. They're kind of like pirates on the high seas. There's maybe a very narrow class of pirates that would qualify, but I think in this case it's a hard argument to make. It's a bit of a stretch because there's no real ongoing war between the Federation and any other state that's associated with Khan, and Khan and his followers aren't really an army per se, so that may not work. The other thing you could try looking at is modern day terrorism cases and question whether Kirk's authority is more like a military commission or tribunal, and could these folks be considered enemy combatants and subject to detention under something parallel to the authorization for use of military force. So the 2009 Military Commissions Act authorized the trial of unprivileged enemy belligerents, including those who purposefully and materially supported hostilities against the U.S. and its coalition partners. So if you substitute Federation for United States, maybe that can provide a rationale for Kirk's actions. Finally, they were found in deep space. It's actually not clear whether they're already subject to some kind of sentence of exile. They're in the Botany Bay, that's associated with a penal colony. So perhaps one reading of the episode is that they're already under some kind of sentence of exile, and Kirk's actions are really just returning them to their previously exiled state. Their life support systems fail, so he fixes that problem, and then he just puts them back. So at the end of the day, if you just can't get jurisdiction, Kirk technically may have overreached. Technically, perhaps what he should have done is taken them all the way to Starbase 12 and then handed them over to the Federation to be tried. But I think if you're the attorney who's trying to advise Kirk, he has to work through a couple of competing issues too. So he has to deal with his immediate safety concern, these people on the ship who are causing a danger. And he also has to deal with crew morale. So if the crew sees MacGyver's get off with a very light punishment compared to what she's actually done, that may cause morale to suffer. He may have discipline problems. But it looks like in this episode, Kirk privileged the safety issues first and just decided, let's just get these people off the ship while everybody's in agreement.
Let's talk about legal loopholes and ensigns of command.
All right, so this is my favorite episode as a lawyer from Next Generation. So the Federation has a treaty with the Shaliak. It has a 500,000-word treaty, which the Shaliak insisted upon because they found our use of language irrational, and so they wanted this level of complexity to specify everything that could possibly happen in advance. As one of the Shaliak put it in the course of the episode, intelligent converse is impossible. You do not discuss. You gibber. So, to avoid gibbering, we have a 500,000-word treaty. One of the things that treaty does is it cedes a particular planet to the Shaliak, and then it provides in Section 501, Paragraph 716, Subparagraph 5, that unwanted life forms inhabiting H-class worlds may be removed at the discretion of the Shaliak corporate. Turns out a bunch of humans have, unbeknownst to them, ended up on a Sheliak world. The Sheliak decide, okay, we're just going to kill them all. Picard is trying to get negotiate some time to get them off the planet. And the Sheliak say, you know, it's in the treaty. We have the right to do this. Too bad. And so I think the subtext here is kind of rules versus standards and law versus equity. To what extent do we follow the rules as written? To what extent do we temper them with justice? And Picard, in another episode called Justice, says there can be no justice as long as laws are absolute. But in this case, the laws are absolute. So what does Picard do? Picard says, well, boy, we better start reading the treaty. Reads through the 500,000-word treaty and finds the key loophole. Pursuant to paragraph 1290, I hereby formally request the third-party arbitration of our dispute. You have the right, says the Sheliak. Furthermore, pursuant to subsection D3, I name the Grisalias to arbitrate. Grisalias? Unfortunately, they're currently in their hibernation cycle. However, they'll awaken in 6 months, at which time we can get this matter settled. Now, do you want me to wait, or you want to give me my 3 weeks? So I love a couple of things about this, right? First off, it's both lawyers as bad, right? That is the 500,000-word treaty with its incomprehensible that no one could actually figure things out. But it's also lawyer as hacker. Right? This is Picard's Kobayashi Maru moment, right? This is Picard saying, I've been confronted with an impossible situation. The people won't leave. The Grisalias won't, Sheliak won't give us time. And I hack the system. I go through and I figure it out. And the way he hacks it is not build some new computer technology. It's figure out the rules and how they can work to your advantage. And that is, in some sense, a lawyer as hero. And to me, a sort of great example of how Next Generation thought about law.
Can I just say one thing? Out of a 500, this is, tells you how weak the concept of lawyering can be. Because out of a 500,000-word document, the entire issue is to equate the word removed with kill. And the whole fight of that episode is, what does the word removed mean? Does it mean take them off the islands, or does it give them the discretion to just take them out?
Well, and I actually, just to say something on that, I do think one of the lessons, if you practice law, is you can use as many words as you like. You will never actually specify away all the ambiguities in a legal issue, right? If you write, no matter how hard you try to write this in an unambiguous manner, lawyers are always going to find the ambiguity.
So we have 4 minutes left, according to a hand that just came through the door. So we're going to have to go through warp speed. So, court martial, Neil and Angela, go.
All right, one of the fascinating things about the Star Trek episodes and a lot of the trials is that the captain is often in a romantic relationship with someone else. And so in one of the prior examples, we had the captain, Picard, who has the judge on the case, and at the very end he says, "Can I buy you dinner?" And she says, "Only if you pay." In this one, Kirk's... ex-girlfriend is prosecuting him for an incident that occurs on the Enterprise, and the key evidence are some computer records and some records of an incident that happened that caused the death of one of the people on the ship, and there is a imprimatur on it that, hey, it's a computer record, computers don't lie, too bad, so sad, you're going to jail. You're being thrown out as captain. And the issue in the case is the reliability of computer records, and how do you challenge that? The first indication of the reliability challenge comes from Spock, who's incapable of lying. And he sees the video, and they said, well, you saw the video, you know, didn't it happen that way? And he says, no, it didn't. And it creates a question as to the accuracy. Ultimately, in the show, it turns out that the computer records were doctored and altered, and so they shouldn't have been given the value that they should have been.
Which brings us to diversity in the practice of law. And anyone want to, Neil, Bethany, why was this so profound in 1967?
Well, I mean, it's really important to point out that this episode first aired on February 2nd, 1967, and it's showing a very diverse panel of judges, a female prosecutor, and also, like, just generally, Star Trek has championed diversity in a wonderful way and also stood for the principle that a governing body and those who make and enforce the rules should be representative of the body that's governed. And I think that's an issue that we really still face today, where you see people making laws who are only a subset of the population, laws affecting a different subset of the population. And now, like, 88% of lawyers in the U.S. and most judges are white. Only 36% of lawyers are women. And only 19% of partners and 4% of managing partners are women. So we really do have a huge diversity problem in law, and that really affects people. And one of the amazing things about Star Trek is that it showed a world that represented these principles, but also just made them commonplace, right? And it was so meaningful for me growing up just to see women as prosecutors, lawyers, and judges, and nobody thought anything of it. It's just how it was. And I think that's a really cool thing about Star Trek.
We should probably open
should we
it up.
Do questions?
In the closing minutes, we probably can get a handful of questions. So, any questions? Yes, sir.
My question is, in Star Trek VI, when they find the conspirator, Polaris, and then remember they're trying to find information, and then Kirk kind of nods at Spock, and then he gives the force mind meld, is that basically assault, and would actually at the end Kirk and Spock been arrested?
They wouldn't have been arrested, and then you get into the issue of forced confessions, and whether or not that would be admissible in court. But you could argue that there was an exigency in trying to stop an assassination attempt in an intergalactic war. So you balance the issues of, it's like torture. Like, we don't allow torture, but we do have a caveat that if there's, like, impending threat of nuclear war, okay. But it's a very high standard, and we don't want that to be the default.
But I do think there is a real issue here, right, that it's an interesting contrast with the Betazoid question, right, and the idea of sort of can my brain and my own thoughts be used against me as self-incrimination, right? I mean, there's a voluntariness, right, that is absent when I basically say, okay, you know what, I'm gonna sort of force mind meld with you, I'm gonna sort of cause you to do these things, even in the service of a good cause.
It would violate the Federation Constitution of right against self-incrimination.
Could then the Federation say then all criminal cases just have a Vulcan mind meld and be used, right?
Well, that's the
but
problem.
But again, it
right.
would violate that yeah. guarantee.
And this is, I mean, I do think this goes to kind of the one of the ultimate issues here, right? Which is we think of law as ultimately really a procedural protection, right? And there are definitely circumstances when we don't get the truth that we would want, right, because of the procedural rules that get in the way, right? But we worry about a system in which people can come in and read your thoughts, in which the government that has the power to sort of come and sort of learn whether you've thought something subversive, right? I think it's one of the things we've built a legal system to try to avoid. And so it's very interesting that, you know, except when it's really necessary.
Yeah, there are exceptions to the Fourth Amendment. You know, we don't allow truth serum. You know, there are huge rules against that sort of thing. And what's in, you know, the first episode of Star Trek, The Man Trap, there's actually a reference about, we'll use truth serum on them, and, like, no one says boo. And so that does come up, that there are some funky, weird civil rights issues that wouldn't fly today. But for Star Trek VI, I think there was enough of an emergency to deviate from the rule of law in order to stop a war. And with that,
you got one more?
Yes, ma'am.
I got here a little late, so excuse me if you touched on this, but, like, Deep Space Nine, like, that was a Cardassian, you know, like, it was Cardassian built, but, you know, the Federation and the Bajorans took over. Like, if you applied today's military law to that, would that necessarily have went down like that?
In Deep Space Nine, the episode Dax, where there's the jurisdictional issue of trying to extradite her for crimes of the past host, they apply Bajoran law because it's a Bajoran station. And that does make sense. When you look at military bases abroad, you know, like if something happens off base, like local law is going to apply, but that gets really complicated really fast. And great question. And we actually have slides from another presentation on that one. So.
But yeah, that and many other things, including the very all sorts of interesting issues around the Prime Directive that.
We didn't even touch on that.
Yeah, we'll have podcasts, so check out our podcast station, because we didn't get to the Trial of Humanity.
Little stuff
like that.
Oh, cut it out, you savages.
I know, and Nimoy sent me a get well card because I nearly died when I was a kid, but that's not important. So, and I did thank him. So with that, he's really nice. Stopped me 3 times. Check out thelegalgeeks.com. Thank you to our panelists, and good luck for the AI panel.